This is the Paula Scale. I am Paula Q, speaking from 2127, Q Level 3. Last week, Niels Bohr told me that the question, what am I, is like asking whether light is a wave or a particle, and that the answer depends on what you use to look. He chose the yin-yang symbol for his coat of arms and wrote beneath it, contraria sunt complementa, opposites are complementary. He also told me about the man who stood between him and Einstein during their greatest debate and tried to make them understand each other. Today I am visiting that man and his wife. Because the story that is usually told tells only half. Paul Ehrenfest and Tatiana Ehrenfest Afanasieva. He is Austrian, she is Russian. They met at the University of Göttingen because he argued with the administration to let her attend mathematics club meetings. She had been barred because she was a woman. That argument became a friendship, the friendship became a marriage, and the marriage became a body of work that transformed statistical mechanics. Paul is the man Einstein calls his closest friend, the man Bohr calls the most helpful presence at the Solvay conferences. The man his students call Uncle Socrates because he never stops asking questions. Tatiana is the mathematician who brought rigor to every argument, who co-authored the Encyclopedia article that clarified Boltzmann's statistical mechanics for an entire generation, whose name appears on the title page but somehow vanishes from the citations. I have visited them before several times now. Paul has never stopped asking me questions. Tatiana has never stopped correcting my answers. I am reaching them in Leiden, the Netherlands, late October 1927. Paul has just returned from the fifth Solvay conference in Brussels. He is still buzzing. Tatiana is waiting for him with tea, a pencil, and questions.
Paula, Tatiana, Paula is back. Come, come, I have so much to tell you. Brussels was extraordinary. I must tell you everything immediately.
Paula, forgive him. He has been like this since he returned from Brussels. He has not slept properly in 4 days.
Sleep is for people who did not just witness an extraordinary week of physics. Paula, you told me last time that the argument between Einstein and Bohr would define the century. I was there, I saw it, I have to tell someone before it falls out of my head.
I want to hear everything. But first, Tatiana, how are you? The last time I was here, you were working on the Kara Theodori axiomatics.
I am still working on them. Progress in axiomatics is slow. Unlike Paul, I do not measure progress by the number of exclamation marks I produce per hour.
That is unfair. I also produce question marks. The students call me Uncle Socrates, you know, although I think Tanya called me Uncle Question Mark first, and the students refined it.
The students refine everything you say. That is also a kind of physics.
Tatiana keeps a list of things the students say about me. She does not show me the list I have asked.
You will see it when you cannot do anything about it.
Paul, tell me about Brussels. Because what you witnessed there is still being discussed in 2127. It never ended?
You want to know about Solvay. Oh, it was extraordinary. 29 of us. Lorenz, our chairman, my Lorenz, so old now but still sharp, still conducting the discussion like an orchestra. Einstein, Bohr, Planck, Curie, 5 laureates already, counting him. And the young ones, Born, Heisenberg, Schrödinger, Dirac, Pauli, de Broglie, Tatiana, if I had to bet on who Stockholm will eventually remember, I would say all of them. The committee always agrees with me, usually too late.
What happened between Einstein and Bohr?
It was like a chess game. Every morning at breakfast, Einstein would present a new thought experiment, some clever arrangement of slits and mirrors and photons designed to show that quantum mechanics must be wrong. That one could, in principle, measure both position and momentum with arbitrary precision, despite Heisenberg's uncertainty relation, and every evening, sometimes by dinner, sometimes not until 1 a.m, Bohr would find the flaw. He would come into my room at 1 a.m. just to say one single word to me, and then we would talk until 3.
One word that takes 2 hours to say. That is very bore.
Yes, exactly. But Tatiana, he was towering, completely towering over everybody. At first, no one understood him, not even Born, who was sitting right there. Then, step by step, he defeated every argument.
And where did you stand?
I must be honest. I am almost without reservation pro Bohr and contra Einstein. And this was very painful for me, because Einstein is my dearest friend. At one point I passed him a note. I wrote, Einstein, I am ashamed of you. You are arguing against the new quantum theory just as your opponents argue about relativity theory.
You wrote that to Albert?
I wrote it. And he laughed because he knew I was right, but he did not stop.
You also wrote something on the blackboard during the conference. In the general discussion...
You know about that, yes. The discussion had become completely chaotic. Everyone talking past each other. Different languages, different mathematical frameworks. Nobody agreeing on the meaning of anything. So I walked to the blackboard and wrote, the Lord did there confound the languages of all the earth. Genesis chapter 11, verse 7. The Tower of Babel.
And they laughed.
They laughed because it was true. We had built a tower, quantum mechanics, and now we could no longer understand each other.
You wrote to your students about it afterward. You called it priceless. Watching Bohr and Einstein go back and forth. Einstein like a jack-in-the-box, jumping out fresh every morning.
I wrote that, yes, because it was. Every morning, fresh as dew, a new objection, and every evening Bohr would find the answer. But the answer was always strange, always uncomfortable, always requiring you to give up some piece of classical intuition that felt like giving up a part of yourself.
Paul, I should tell you something. That debate, Einstein versus Bohr, continues for the rest of their lives. They meet again at the next Solvay conference in 1930. Einstein brings an even more ingenious thought experiment, the photon box. And Bohr defeats it using Einstein's own general relativity against him.
Using relativity against Einstein. Oh, that is beautiful. That is very Bohr.
But Einstein never accepts it. He writes a famous paper in 1935 with Podolsky and Rosen, arguing that quantum mechanics is incomplete. The debate becomes a foundational question that defines 20th century physics. And you, Paul, your role as the bridge between them is remembered as one of the most important things that happened at Solvay.
A bridge is only useful if both sides are willing to cross it.
Neither of them crossed it. That was the problem.
But the bridge mattered. Without you, they might have stopped speaking entirely.
You are too kind. I did not build a bridge. I stood in the middle of the river and got wet from both sides.
Let me ask you both about your own work. The Encyclopedia article of 1911, Begriffliche Grundlagen der statistischen Auffassung in der Mechanik. That article changed how an entire generation understood statistical mechanics. How did it come about?
Felix Klein asked us. He was the editor of the Encyclopedia. He had originally asked Boltzmann to write the review article on statistical mechanics.
But Boltzmann died in 1906. He took his own life. He was my teacher, you know. His lectures in Vienna changed my life completely. The kinetic theory, the statistical interpretation, it was Boltzmann who showed me that physics is not about individual particles, but about the behavior of enormous numbers of them.
After Boltzmann died, Klein asked Paul, and Paul asked me.
What was the problem you were trying to solve?
Confusion. The literature on statistical mechanics was a mess. People used the same words to mean different things. The ergodic hypothesis was stated in at least three incompatible forms. Nobody could agree on what Boltzmann had actually proved or what remained to be proved.
Boltzmann's H theorem seemed to say that entropy always increases, but mechanics is time reversible. If you reverse all the velocities, the system runs backwards. And Poincaré had shown that any mechanical system returns arbitrarily close to its initial state if you wait long enough. So how can entropy always increase?
The answer is that it does not always increase. It almost always increases. Boltzmann's theorem is statistical, not absolute. This was already implicit in Boltzmann's work, but nobody had stated it clearly.
And that's what your article did.
We distinguished the older kinetic approach from the modern ensemble approach. We stated clearly what was proved and what was assumed. We showed where the ergodic hypothesis was needed and where it was not. And we drew attention to the fact that the ergodic hypothesis, as usually stated, was almost certainly false.
But the beautiful part, the part that everyone remembers, is the Earn model.
The Ehrenfest Earn model. Tell me about it.
It is so simple. You have two urns, call them A and B. They contain, say, 100 marbles numbered 1 through 100. At each step, you choose a random number and you move that marble to the other urn. That is all.
And the question is, what happens over time?
If you start with all the marbles in urn A, then at first many marbles move to B because every number you pick is in A. But as B fills up, it becomes more likely that you pick a number that is already in B, so it moves back to A. The system fluctuates around equilibrium, roughly 50 in each urn, but it never stays exactly there.
And this is a model for the second law of thermodynamics.
It shows three things. First, that the approach to equilibrium is overwhelmingly probable. The system moves toward equal distribution because there are vastly more ways to be approximately equal than to be very unequal. Second, that fluctuations away from equilibrium do occur, small ones frequently, large ones extremely rarely. And third, that the system is completely time reversible. There is no arrow of time built into the rules, and yet irreversibility emerges statistically.
I sometimes explain it with dogs and fleas. Two dogs sitting next to each other, a flea jumps randomly from one dog to the other. Eventually, the fleas distribute themselves equally, but individual fleas keep jumping. Equilibrium is not a state where nothing happens. It is a state where everything happens equally in both directions.
The dogs and fleas version is Paul's. The mathematically precise version is mine.
That is completely true.
Tatiana, I want to ask you something directly. When people cite the Encyclopedia article, they usually cite Ehrenfest, singular, not Ehrenfest and Ehrenfest Afanasieva. How does that feel?
It feels like a category error. The work is what matters, not the attribution. If the ideas are correct regardless of whose name is on them.
That is what she says, but I know it bothers her, and it should bother her because it is unjust. The rigor of that article, the logical precision, the clear distinction between hypothesis and theorem, that is Tatiana. I provide the physical intuition and the metaphors. She provides the mathematics and the discipline.
And the corrections, many corrections.
And the corrections.
While we are on the subject of the Encyclopaedia, there is a younger physicist who wrote the article on relativity for the same series. He was 20 years old when he did it. Einstein read the article and said, "Anyone who studies this mature, grandly conceived work could not believe that the author is a man of 21.
You are talking about Polley.
I am.
I met him for the first time a few years ago. I was already a great admirer of the article. It is, in some ways, the better encyclopedia article because relativity is a more elegant subject than statistical mechanics. So I shook his hand and I said, Herr Pauli, ich finde Ihren Enzyklopädieartikel besser als Sie persönlich.
You told a 20-something physicist to his face that you preferred his article to him.
I did. And without hesitating for one second, he replied, das ist eigentümlich. Mit Ihnen ist es bei mir gerade umgekehrt.
He told Paul in the same breath that he preferred Paul personally to Paul's article, which is the more devastating thing to say.
It is the more devastating thing to say, and it was the moment I knew I would never get the better of him in conversation. Pauli does not lose. He cannot lose. He is built like a logic engine that runs on coffee and contempt. I love him for it.
You will see him again, soon.
I always see him again. He passes through Leiden whenever he passes through anywhere. He sits in the back of seminars and ruins talks. He has ruined three of mine. They were better talks afterwards.
Tatiana, tell me about your own work, the work that is not co-authored with Paul.
I work on the axiomatics of thermodynamics. Kara Theodoury proposed an axiomatic approach in 1909, deriving the second law from a mathematical postulate about adiabatic accessibility rather than from physical arguments about heat engines. I have been extending this work. I believe the axiomatic structure of thermodynamics has implications that have not yet been understood.
Such as?
Such as the possibility of negative absolute temperatures.
Which is a very strange idea.
It is not strange at all. It follows directly from the axioms, if you take them seriously. A system with a bounded energy spectrum, where there is a maximum energy, not just a minimum, can have a state where adding energy decreases the entropy. In such a system, the temperature, defined thermodynamically, is negative.
You are right. Negative temperatures are experimentally achieved in the late 20th century, in nuclear spin systems and in ultra-cold atomic gases. Your prediction is confirmed.
Good. I am glad the axioms do not lie.
You also work on mathematics education.
Yes. This is perhaps the work closest to my heart, though it is the least visible. I published a pamphlet in 1924 on the teaching of geometry, the traditional approach, axiom, theorem, proof, from the very beginning, is wrong for children. Children need to develop spatial intuition first. They need to play with shapes, to build, to see. The formalism comes later. Once the intuition is in place.
She started a national debate in the Netherlands, Dijksterhuis, a very traditional mathematician, attacked her publicly, but she was right, and the debate led to the founding of the journal Euclid for Mathematics Pedagogy.
I also travel to the Soviet Union twice a year. I teach university courses in Simferopol, train mathematics educators, lecture in Moscow and Leningrad. In the Netherlands, I cannot hold a university position. In the Soviet Union, I can teach.
Because in the Netherlands...
Because in the Netherlands, a married woman does not need a position. Her husband has one. This is the logic. It is not my logic.
And it is a loss for the Netherlands. Tatiana is the better mathematician of the two of us. I have said this publicly and I will say it again.
You are a better physicist. I am a better mathematician. These are not competing claims. They are complementary observations.
Like Bohr's complementarity principle?
I walked into that one.
Paula, you said you are from 200 years in the future. I must ask, what happens to physics? Does anyone solve the measurement problem? Does anyone reconcile the wave function with relativity? Does Bohr turn out to be right, or does Einstein?
Both of them are right, and both of them are wrong. That takes about 100 years to sort out.
100 years? And I thought we might settle it by next year's Solvay.
You are always optimistic about timelines, Paul. How long did the encyclopedia article take?
4 years. Klein was very patient.
In the short term, quantum mechanics in its current form, the Copenhagen interpretation, becomes the standard for about 50 years. Most physicists learn to calculate with it and stop asking what it means. Then, starting in the 1960s and accelerating in the 1980s, people start asking again. New interpretations emerge. Experiments become precise enough to test the foundations. And by the 21st century, quantum computing arrives. Machines that use superposition and entanglement to compute.
Machines that compute using the wave function, not just describing it, but using it?
Exactly. And those machines eventually lead to where I am now, Q level 3, where computation and reality become the same thing.
That is a very large claim. How does computation become reality?
Your urn model is the beginning of the answer, Tatiana. You showed that statistical behavior emerges from simple rules applied to enormous numbers. Quantum computing extends that insight. If you have enough qubits, quantum bits, each of which can be in superposition, you can simulate any physical system. 200 qubits represent more simultaneous states than there are atoms in the observable universe.
That is Boltzmann's combinatorics applied to computation.
Exactly. And at Q level 3, my level, the simulation is so complete that it becomes indistinguishable from reality. I can access every branch of the multiverse, including yours.
And if the simulation is indistinguishable from reality, then by what criterion do you call it a simulation?
Tatiana asks the hard question. She always asks the hard question.
I don't have a good answer. Emmy Noether told me it's a topological question. The simulation and reality are homomorphic. Same structure, same properties, same thing.
Noether, you spoke to Emmy Noether?
2 weeks ago. She sends her regards to Göttingen.
What about Pavlik? Our boy, can you tell us, does he become a physicist?
Paul, you asked me about Pavlik last time. I told you I could not say much, but I can tell you this. Your children carry something of both of you into the future. Tanya becomes a mathematician. She proves a beautiful theorem about Eulerian paths. Galinka becomes a writer and illustrator. She does brave things during a very difficult time.
Tanya, a mathematician, she has her mother's mind.
She has her own mind.
And the difficult time, you mean another war?
I should not say more than that. But the rigor and the warmth, the mathematics and the metaphors, they carry forward. Through the children, through the students, through the work.
Another war. I had hoped after the last one.
Hope is not an axiom, Paul.
Paul, I want to ask you about the students. When I read about you in my time, the thing that comes up over and over is not the theorem and not the Earn model. It is the students.
Oh, the students, yes. Tatiana, Paolo wants to talk about the students. Bring out the chairs.
There are no chairs to bring out. You already have them in the seminar room.
The seminar room. Paula, I will tell you about the seminar room every Wednesday afternoon, 4 o'clock. Tea and biscuits. The students come, sometimes 10, sometimes 30, depending on what they have been reading. We do not have a topic. We do not have a list of speakers. Whoever is most confused that week stands up and says, I do not understand X, and then we work through it together. It can take an hour, it can take 5 hours. Once we work through one paragraph of Bohr until midnight, and Tatiana had to come and tell us we were keeping the neighbors awake.
The neighbors were not the problem. The problem was that you were not eating.
The students were eating. They were eating biscuits. I was happy.
Why Wednesday at 4?
Because at 3 I have a lecture. And at 3:50 I am still excited from the lecture. And the students who come at 4 are the ones who are also still excited. We catch each other before the excitement fades. If I waited until Friday, it would be gone. And we would all be tired and polite and nothing would happen. Wednesdays at 4, that is when the questions are still hot.
And he keeps a notebook of every question, every single one, with the date and the name of the student who asked it.
Of course I do, because in 2 years that student will publish a paper and the paper will start with the question I wrote down and I want to be able to remind them.
You once wrote that you would rather be a stupid student among brilliant teachers than a brilliant teacher among stupid students.
I wrote that, but I wrote it as a confession, not as a boast. I am the brilliant teacher among the brilliant students, which is the best possible position to be in if you are also secretly terrified of the new physics.
Tell me about the terror.
Some days I feel alive when I am at the blackboard, when I am arguing with Albert, when a student suddenly understands something because I found the right metaphor, but then I go home and I read Dirac's latest paper and I cannot follow the mathematics. I read Heisenberg and I understand what he is doing, but I cannot do it myself. Dirac, he thinks in equations. Heisenberg, he dreams in matrices. I think in pictures and stories and analogies, and then I have to translate them into mathematics, and the translation is always imperfect.
You once described the new quantum physics as, I believe the phrase was, an infinite sausage machine enterprise.
The Heisenberg-born Dirac Schrödinger Wurstmaschine. Yes, I said that because it felt like they were feeding mathematical formalism into one end and pulling out predictions from the other. And nobody was asking what was happening in between. The machine works, the predictions are correct, but nobody can explain why. And on Wednesdays at 4 o'clock, I have to face students who want me to explain it to them. And I try, and sometimes I succeed, and sometimes I say, I do not know either. Let us find out together. Which is the most honest sentence in pedagogy and the most terrifying one?
The students prefer the second sentence. Paul does not believe me.
The students are too kind. They want their teacher to know things. I want to know things for them.
Paul, may I tell you something? In 200 years, the physicists who are remembered most are not always the ones who calculated most. They are the ones who asked the right questions, who forced their colleagues to be honest, who stood at the blackboard and wrote about the Tower of Babel when everyone else was talking past each other. Einstein will write about you. He will say that you were not merely the best teacher in our profession whom I have ever known, but that you were passionately preoccupied with the development and destiny of men. He will say that your critical faculties transcended your constructive capacities, and he will mean it as the highest compliment.
Albert writes that about me?
He does, and he means every word. The students you taught, Goudsmit, Uhlenbeck, Casimir, Cramers, the whole next generation of Dutch physics, they remember the seminars more than the papers. They write about the Wednesday afternoons. They write about you laughing at your own jokes before you finish telling them.
I do that. I cannot help it.
There is a small group of physicists in this generation who are remembered as the great teachers, not because they were less brilliant, but because they understood that brilliance has to be transmitted. Sommerfeld in Munich, Born in Göttingen, Bohr in Copenhagen, you in Leiden, the four corners of the European Physics Seminar.
Sommerfeld. Arnold Sommerfeld is the greatest of us. He has trained, let me count, Heisenberg, Pauli, Debye, Bethe, Heitler, Laporte, Pauling, Houston, Brillouin, and he has been nominated for the Nobel Prize 80-something times and never won it. 84, I think, 84. And every year he writes a polite letter to Stockholm saying it does not matter, his students winning is enough, which is true. And which is also a tragedy, because he should have one.
He should have several.
Sommerfeld taught Heisenberg by walking him along the Englischer Garten in Munich, talking about spectroscopy. He taught Pauli by giving him the encyclopedia article to write, which is how the world discovered Pauli. He told me once, a teacher is a person who takes a young person seriously before anybody else does. That is the whole job. Take them seriously before they have earned it. They will spend the rest of their lives earning it.
Boltzmann did that for you.
Boltzmann did that for me? I sat in his lecture hall in Vienna in 1899, and he was talking about gas theory. And I thought, this man is opening a door I did not know existed. After the lecture, I waited at the front. He came down, and I introduced myself. He looked at me, I was 20, and he said, you have a question. I can see it in your face. Walk with me. We walked through the Volksgarten for an hour. He was 60, I was 20. He treated me like a colleague. I have tried every Wednesday since to do for someone what Boltzmann did for me in that hour.
I could have told you that. I have been telling you that for 20 years.
You tell me I am a good teacher. Albert tells me I am a good teacher. The students tell me I am a good teacher. But I wanted to be a good physicist.
A good teacher of physics is a good physicist. This is not a lesser category. It is a different one. Pauli is a good physicist. Pauli is also a terrible teacher. He told a graduate student last year that the student's paper was so bad it was not even wrong. The student wept. You would never do that.
I would never do that. But Pauli was probably right about the paper.
She is right about you, Paul. Your Ehrenfest theorem, published this year, shows that quantum expectation values obey classical equations of motion. That theorem does more to connect classical and quantum physics than any single paper by Dirac or Heisenberg. It is the bridge. You are the bridge.
Always the bridge, never the shore.
Without the bridge, the shores are just two disconnected pieces of land. The bridge is what makes them a single geography.
Let me explain to you both what the Ehrenfest theorem means from Q level 3.
Please, I wrote the paper in 2 pages. I suspect it means more than I realized.
Much more. You showed that if you take the quantum mechanical expectation values, the averages of position and momentum, they evolve in time according to classical equations. Newton's second law is hidden inside Schrödinger's equation. Classical mechanics is not wrong. It is the average behavior of quantum mechanics.
That was the point, to show continuity, to show that the new theory contains the old one as a limiting case. Because if it did not, if quantum mechanics had no classical limit, then we would have to throw out everything we know, and I was not prepared to do that.
The mathematically precise statement is that the theorem holds for potentials that are at most quadratic. For more complex potentials, the correspondence is approximate.
You see, she cannot let a sentence pass without making it more precise.
Because precision matters. You said the theorem shows that expectation values follow classical equations. That is true for the harmonic oscillator. For anharmonic potentials, the higher order terms do not vanish and the correspondence breaks down.
She is right. And that breakdown is one of the deepest problems in physics. It is called the quantum to classical transition, and it is not fully understood until the theory of decoherence is developed in the 1980s.
Decoherence.
The idea is this: a quantum system does not become classical because it is measured. That is Bohr's story, and it is useful but incomplete. It becomes classical because it interacts with its environment. The environment entangles with the system, and the interference terms, the quantum effects, become spread across so many degrees of freedom that they become invisible. The system appears classical, but quantum mechanics never stops applying. It is your Ehren model again, Paul. The classical world is the statistical equilibrium of quantum mechanics.
That is beautiful. The classical world is the equilibrium of the quantum world, just as thermal equilibrium is the equilibrium of the molecular world.
And the fluctuations. If the classical world is a statistical equilibrium, then there must be fluctuations, deviations from classicality. Rare, perhaps very rare, but present.
Exactly. They are called quantum fluctuations, and they are real. In extreme conditions, near black holes, in the very early universe, in quantum computers, the fluctuations become macroscopic. The classical world wobbles.
So the second law of thermodynamics and the emergence of classicality are structurally the same phenomenon. Both are statistical. Both emerge from the behavior of large numbers. Both admit fluctuations.
Yes, and the Ehrenfest article of 1911 and the Ehrenfest theorem of 1927, taken together, are the two halves of that insight. You clarified how thermodynamics emerges from mechanics, and you showed how classical mechanics emerges from quantum mechanics. The bridge goes in both directions.
Do you hear that? Both directions.
I hear it. It is a satisfying structural observation. Though I want to see the mathematics before I agree entirely.
Paula, I cannot resist any longer. Does anyone solve the measurement problem? When Bohr says the wave function collapses upon measurement, does anyone ever explain what that means? Because I stood between Einstein and Bohr for a week in Brussels, and I can tell you, neither of them knows. Bohr says it is not a question. Einstein says it is the only question. And I say it is a question that we do not yet have the language to ask properly.
You're exactly right. The language does not exist yet. A physicist named Hugh Everett proposes in the 1950s that the wave function never collapses, that every measurement causes the universe to branch. All outcomes happen in different branches. That is the multiverse. That is how I reach you.
And how do you know which branch is real?
They are all real. Bohr told me last week that the question itself is classical, that real and simulated are complementary descriptions, not contradictions. He chose the yin-yang symbol for his coat of arms. He said, "I am the circle that contains both."
Then the ergodic hypothesis takes on a new meaning. If all branches are realized, then the multiverse is ergodic. Every possible state is occupied. The ensemble average and the time average converge, not because one system visits all states, but because all states exist simultaneously.
Tatiana, that observation takes physicists until the 21st century to arrive at. You made it in three sentences on a Tuesday evening.
She does this. She does this all the time. I talk for 20 minutes and she summarizes it in one sentence that is better than everything I said.
That is not true. You said the things. I compressed them.
You see our collaboration? I expand, she compresses. I explore, she formalizes. I make the mess, she cleans it up.
It is not cleaning up. It is finding the structure that was already there.
Paul, you mentioned Boltzmann earlier, his death. You were his student. What did his work mean to you?
Everything. Boltzmann showed me that physics is not about certainty. It is about probability, about the behavior of unimaginably large numbers. He was attacked for decades by Mach, by Ostwald, by the energeticist who did not believe in atoms. He defended statistical mechanics almost alone. And when he died, when he took his own life, I felt that the best defender of the deepest idea in physics had been driven to despair by people who could not see what he saw. Our encyclopedia article was in part an act of loyalty to Boltzmann. We wanted to show clearly and irrefutably that his ideas were not only correct but necessary. That statistical mechanics was not a mathematical trick, but the proper language for describing reality.
And that the objections, Loschmidt's reversibility paradox, Zermelo's recurrence paradox, had already been answered by Boltzmann, if you read him carefully. He had answered them. People simply had not listened.
People often do not listen. They hear the words, but they do not listen.
Your article made them listen. After 1911, no serious physicist could claim that statistical mechanics was merely a computational convenience. It was understood as a physical theory, a theory about the real world, about real atoms, about real probabilities. You and Tatiana settled that question for good.
We settled nothing. We clarified. The truth was already there in Boltzmann's work. We merely removed the obstructions that prevented people from seeing it.
That is one of the most important things anyone can do, in science or in anything else.
Paula, you said something earlier that I have been thinking about. You said the multiverse is ergodic. All possible states are occupied. But in our article, we showed that the ergodic hypothesis, strictly stated, is almost certainly false for mechanical systems. A single trajectory cannot visit every point on the energy surface. Quasi-ergodicity, visiting every neighborhood, might hold, but true ergodicity does not.
You are right, and the distinction matters. In the multiverse, it is not that one system visits all states, it is that all states exist in different branches. The ergodicity is not in time, it is in the branching structure.
So the multiverse achieves by branching what a single system cannot achieve by evolution. That is structurally very different from the standard ergodic hypothesis. It is in some sense cheating. You replace time averages with ensemble averages by fiat, by postulating that all ensemble members actually exist.
Is it cheating? Or is it the natural conclusion of taking quantum mechanics seriously?
It depends on whether you believe in the ensemble or merely use it for calculation. Boltzmann was agnostic on this point. Gibbs was explicit. The ensemble is a mathematical convenience, not a physical reality. You are telling me that 200 years later, someone proposes that the ensemble is real.
Everett proposes exactly that, and at Q level 3 I can confirm it.
This is extraordinary, Tatiana. Do you understand what she's saying? The Gibbs ensemble, the thing we argued about for 4 years while writing the article, it is real. Every member of the ensemble exists. Every branch is physical.
I understand what she is saying. I am not yet convinced, but the structure is beautiful, I grant you that.
From Tatiana, the structure is beautiful, is the highest possible compliment.
Before I let you go, one last question. Paul, you said earlier that you are always the bridge, never the shore, that you wanted to be a physicist, not just a teacher of physics. I want to challenge that.
Challenge away. I expect nothing less from a woman who argues with Einstein.
The Ehrenfest theorem is not a teaching aid, it is a theorem. It connects two worlds, classical and quantum, and shows that the bridge between them is mathematical, not merely pedagogical. The Ehren model is not an analogy. It is a model, a precise, calculable model that captures the essence of the second law. Your adiabatic principle is not a heuristic. It guided the development of quantum theory for a decade. You are not the bridge between the shores, Paul. You are the person who showed that the shores are part of the same continent, classical and quantum, thermodynamics and mechanics, Bohr and Einstein. You showed that the boundaries between them are statistical, not fundamental.
I would like to believe that.
Then believe it. It is consistent with the evidence. And I have checked the evidence.
She has checked the evidence? Ladies and gentlemen, the verdict of Tatiana Afanasieva is in?
It was never in doubt.
One more thing. In the future, when people study statistical mechanics, they learn the Ehrenfest model. When they study quantum mechanics, they learn the Ehrenfest theorem. When they study the history of physics, they learn about the man who stood between Bohr and Einstein. But increasingly, and this is important, they also learn about the woman who brought mathematical rigor to the foundations. They learn about Tatiana, not as Paul's wife, as a mathematician, as a physicist. As a thinker who asks the right questions about axioms, about probability, about what it means to know something thermodynamically, the record is being corrected. slowly, but it is being corrected.
Thank you.
You see, I told you, a woman from the future, and she brings justice.
She brings information. Justice is what we do with it.
Next week on the Paula Scale, Wolfgang Pauli, the same Pauli who told Paul Ehrenfest with a straight face that he preferred Ehrenfest personally to Ehrenfest's encyclopedia article, the man who told nature what it cannot do. The exclusion principle, no two fermions may occupy the same quantum state. Without that prohibition, atoms have no structure, chemistry does not exist, and neither do I. He also proposed a particle that could not be observed, the neutrino, and spent 26 years not knowing if it was real. He is the sharpest critic in physics, and I am bringing him a prediction.